Serving up the web. Introduction. The internet is still, at some level, a physical entity. Servers of some kind are essential. Whenever you type in a website's URL, the browser begins a behind-the-scenes search for the server's actual numeric address. The result of that search will, for the user, feel like an interaction with a single entity, the server for the website that's been requested. In reality, you may be interacting with a couple of servers, or many. The server and the browser interact in order to produce, under the right circumstances, a seamless experience for the user. Browsers, too, are a kind of web platform, consisting of rendering engines, a JavaScript interpreter, and a variety of other technologies. The tools that a developer chooses to work with when developing upon these platforms is called the development stack. Like most things related to the internet, there are a variety of stacks, and they have different pros and cons. The tools are always changing, and new technologies are always emerging. We'll take a look at a few. Servers, servers everywhere. Somewhere, someplace, the website you're browsing is hosted on at least one actual hunk of plastic and metal. Large sites will be hosted on a number of these hunks, sometimes a very large number. Occasionally, the website you're browsing is hosted on a single server, whirring away in some closet in someone's office. More often, sites are hosted by servers located in racks in a larger, temperature-controlled hosting facility. Very large sites will be hosted on multiple servers connected to separate database servers, and all of these will be accessed through other systems that determine where to route requests, and so on. A site's content might come from one server, its multimedia assets from another server, and user and session information from yet another server. All of this can become quite complicated. As a developer, most of the time you won't be responsible for all of this, but it helps to begin understanding how these systems can work. A web server is a combination of hardware and software. The hardware will vary according to what the server is intended to host, but these are the ideas to keep in mind. CPU. The central processing unit is a computer's primary brain, the component that manages the computer's overall operation through billions of calculations per second. Most home computers come with one CPU, but servers will often have two or more in order to enable the faster and simultaneous execution of multiple programs. If a web server is going to get a lot of traffic, say hundreds or thousands, or more of simultaneous connections processing thousands or millions of requests, then multiple CPUs will be necessary. RAM. Random access memory is the main memory of a modern computer system. The more main memory a server has available, the less often the server will have to write temporary files to its disk drives, and that means the server gets faster, more responsive, and less prone to failure, though RAM can fail too. Storage. The typical home PC or laptop will have hard drives, just like a server, but servers use different configurations in order to protect data. For example, servers will often use external drive arrays, called RAID configurations, or redundant array of independent disks, in order to make sure that data isn't lost in case one or more of the drives suddenly fails. There are different methods of implementing RAID, and they have different advantages. Because of RAID's higher costs, though, this kind of data protection isn't usually found on home computers. Most often, hosting providers will offer storage on SSD, solid-state drives, which are very fast and generally reliable. SSDs don't have the moving components associated with older hard disk technology. Generally, this is the kind of storage that you'll want to be shopping for. Web servers will also run an HTTP server. An HTTP server is the software that serves the actual HTML, CSS, and JavaScript files in response to an HTTP request from a client like a browser. One of the oldest and still most commonly encountered web servers is the Apache server, which serves more than a third of all active websites. Click here for some other common HTTP servers. Check out Microsoft's IIS and Nginx. The web depends upon other kinds of servers too. Mail servers, sending and receiving email, load balancers, software and hardware that distributes HTTP requests to multiple HTTP servers according to a set of criteria, database servers, servers that run database software and which respond to different kinds of requests from large data stores, and so on. The hardware for all of these servers will be in some ways similar, multiple CPUs at times, significant amounts of main memory, and robust storage schemes. The software will vary depending upon the server's role. It's not uncommon, though, for small, special interest, or hobbyist websites to run an HTTP server, a database, and a mail server all on one consumer-oriented PC. Server configurations vary along with budgets, demands, and a site's purpose. The most common way to communicate with a server to provide necessary input is to use a terminal emulator program. These will typically be called terminal on most platforms. Terminal emulators are command line interfaces that emulate old-style computer terminals. You type in commands at a prompt and receive various kinds, usually text, of output, responses to those commands, depending upon the command. The terminal functions like a screen, even though the server itself isn't usually connected to a display. This might seem old-fashioned. In a way, it is. But this is a surprisingly fast and efficient way to communicate with a server. You can communicate with Windows servers like this too, through graphical interfaces, if you prefer. The experience is similar to using a computer in a normal way, except that you use a program that provides a graphical view of the server's screen. In fact, again, the screen is usually virtual. You're just interacting with an interface. The Internet of Things. In fact, it's not as easy to define in precise terms what it means to be a server on the web. Particularly during the 21st century, the Internet has evolved into what's known as the Internet of Things, IoT. This is the increasing tendency to think of the Internet, and the web too, as an interactive space that can communicate with everyday appliances and devices. Phones, smart refrigerators, thermostats, light controls, Amazon's Alexa service, sensors that monitor a garden's nutrient levels, weather stations, these are just a few of the components of a growing network where any of these things could be a client, or a server, or both. This proliferation of devices acting as sensors and servers generates mountains of data. All of that data is stored in a cloud environment, a large network of servers and data storage devices that collects masses of data. Advanced analytical methods are used to sort through the data in order to get at useful insights. Those insights are then accessed or returned through other servers that provide interfaces to it. This is the modern web environment, and it has profoundly changed the way developers think of websites and development. Sites in the mid-1990s were often static HTML pages that provided basic information. Sites today are often entire software services that interact with everyday items we carry around with us. Because of that, developers must carefully take into account the kinds of data a site will access, how it will be structured, and the kinds of interfaces that will be developed to represent the insights mined from it. Making the world go round. The Internet of Cha-Chings. E-commerce adds to the number of technology and development requirements for both the website's code and the server itself. E-commerce is the online processing of exchanges of currency for products or services. Because e-commerce involves interacting with account numbers and sensitive information relating to an individual's or business's legal identity, technologies and development techniques that provide security and ensure honesty, as much as possible, are of the highest importance. E-commerce is routinely categorized according to transaction participants. Yes, that's a confusing sentence, so take a look at some examples. B2C, business to consumer. This is probably what most people are thinking about when they hear the term e-commerce. This just refers to a business selling goods or services to consumers. Ever purchase anything online from Best Buy or Amazon? If so, you were the C in B2C. B2B, business to business. This is businesses selling stuff to other businesses. This accounts for a lot of online, big-dollar transactions. C2C, consumer to consumer. Hello, Internet. Someone want to buy my old table? If you're selling something on eBay, then you're a consumer reaching out to, most often, other consumers. Because eBay processes transactions, this is a form of e-commerce with all of the usual requirements. B2G, business to government. This is businesses selling goods and services to government entities. So what's the point of all this X2X categorization? E-commerce, as previously indicated, is more complicated than simply putting a website online, often because of the way certain customers in certain categories are accustomed to doing business. The website involved needs to provide special features, guarantees, forms of payment, shipping options, or other transactional elements that cater to those customers. You might not be able to do business with government agencies, for example, unless you're able to provide certain kinds of shipping or payment options, depending upon what you're selling. So it's useful to think about various kinds of e-commerce in terms of these categories. There are other ways of categorizing e-commerce too. You can think of e-commerce in terms of different kinds of products or services, or even different devices like mobile versus desktop. The main thing to keep in mind is that the way you're conceiving of e-commerce will and should have an effect on the features provided by the website, the requirements for the server, and the user interface that's created by a developer. For servers in e-commerce applications, or really in any context where you want to protect your information, you'll need to have a security certificate. A security certificate is issued by a CA, a certificate authority, who has the job of ensuring that you own the domain you're going to certify. A domain is the name you've registered with a domain name registrar, a business that has the authority to sell domain names to individuals and businesses. We'll take a look at that process soon. CAs demand various pieces of information and proof from you, the owner of your domain, and then they issue a security certificate, or SSL certificate, that is a set of numbers that allows a web developer to modify their server in order to encrypt communications between the server and a browser. Browsers come with lists of CAs they trust, so when a browser makes a connection with a secure site, this is indicated by the S in https://, in the site's URL, they check the authority and the site certificate. If everything encrypts and decrypts correctly, the user can be confident that they're dealing with a secure site and that their transactions are reasonably safe. Note, reasonably safe is the right idea. No security measures are either perfect or absolute. E-commerce servers will also implement daily backups and should be relatively high performance in order to avoid technical issues that can arise when servers are being overworked, disks are being accessed too often, etc. In addition to implementing a security certificate, which is mandatory, good e-commerce developers will do things like the following. Never store credit card numbers or other primary payment information on the server. Only store a user's passwords in encrypted format. This will mean that if a user loses their password, and they will, there will need to be a password recovery method. But it also means that it's much more difficult to steal a password. Provide two-factor authentication. This means allowing a user to enter a password, but then requiring them to enter a code number, or some other kind of verification, that's generated by a personal device in the user's possession, typically a phone. This form of authentication is much more secure and is offered by sites like Amazon. Conduct regularly scheduled security audits on a site's servers. This means running virus scans and checking logs to make sure that no one has compromised the server. Updating server software to ensure that the latest security updates are always in place. This, in fact, is a very important practice. These are just a few common security practices, but you can start to get an idea of how much more work is involved when you start dealing with a customer's money. In fact, not following good security practices can even expose a developer to potential lawsuits. Going live. Our producer friend, JT, makes some dope beats, but she doesn't know much about the web. When you told her that she was going to start being charged $16 per month for a hosting fee, she wanted to know why you couldn't just host the site on your development server at home. After all, she has been hooking you up with access to the best shows. Seems only fair. And it is fair, or would be. But while it's possible to host a website from your home computer, and some tech-oriented people do, in fact, do this for small, low-stakes sites, it's not a great idea for any site that needs to be reliable, secure, and relatively free from trouble. While it's true that when you run your own personal server, you have great power over that server, the problem is that you have great power over that server. We all know it comes with great power, great responsibility. A good hosting provider, a company that hosts sites from a dedicated facility called a data center that often houses hundreds and sometimes thousands of servers, will provide some services and guarantees that will be difficult for someone hosting at home to match. When you host a server at home, you're responsible for server maintenance and uptime, or the percentage of time a server is online and available to serve. Server maintenance is a real task and a somewhat tedious one, which has its own set of required skills. The internet connection at your home is likely to be much slower and much less robust than the kinds of connections available at a good data center. Connections at data centers will be dedicated lines, and they'll be redundant. Outages will be far less frequent. Data centers will also ensure that your site stays online, even when they have to maintain your server. They do this by temporarily serving your site from another server. And servers consume electricity. Someone has to pay that bill, too. There are also some technical hurdles related to exposing a server to the web in general and making sure that it's secure. For now, know that these are real problems. They have solutions, but is that the business you want to be in? Most often, it just makes sense to go with a good hosting provider. A good hosting provider will supply all of the things necessary for a good server and for a pretty competitive monthly or yearly fee. There are a few things to consider when deciding upon which hosting provider to use. History and reliability. Be sure you're going with a provider that's been around for a while and has strong reviews. Google hosting provider reviews, and so on. This kind of evaluation alone isn't foolproof, but it's helpful. Technical support. What kinds of support do they offer? Phone? Email? Contact form? Are they around 24/7 or do they disappear on weekends? Will they help set up software or logs, or are they available only for emergencies? Server access. Do you get to log into your server? Do they provide a control panel where you can install and configure other software packages? Most importantly, do they offer a kind of access that you're comfortable with using? Available features. Evaluate the amounts and any possible additional rates for the following. Storage. How much comes with servers at various price points? Bandwidth. How much traffic will your server be allowed to receive and send? Analytics. What kind of user tracking do they offer so you know who's visiting your site, how often, and from where? SEO. Do they have any search engine optimization features or support? Software installation. What HTTP servers, database engines, and other software packages can be installed on their servers? Guarantees. One of the most important guarantees is called uptime, the percentage of time your server will be available to serve your site and for you to access and work with. You want 100%. And while no provider will likely guarantee continuous uptime, their promise should be hovering close to that level. Price. This might not be the final consideration depending upon your situation, but it's still important. As with anything, you get what you pay for. The point isn't necessarily to find the lowest price point, though. The aim is to find the right price point for your client and your business goals. Sometimes that will mean the lowest price, but sometimes that will mean, well, something else. When you're comparing hosting providers, it's useful to make a spreadsheet with columns dedicated to each category. That way you can note each provider's offerings and make a judgment according to the needs of your client and the development team. Choosing a domain. Web addresses are characterized by the site's domain. A domain is the first part of a web address, often but not necessarily preceded by www or some other subdomain. Whenever you type an address into your browser's address bar, the browser queries a special server that's managed by your internet service provider, called a DNS server. The domain name system is a large network of servers that provides a kind of database that maps a domain name to the numeric addresses that networked nodes are identified with on the internet. Those numeric addresses are called IP addresses, and every computer and device connected to the internet is assigned one as its own unique identifier. Domains themselves are made up of a few parts. The top-level domain, or TLD, is often the very last part of a domain. Sometimes there's a country code at the very end. The TLD is typically the .com or .net that you're accustomed to seeing. Keep in mind, though, that there are over 1,000 additional TLDs. That's a lot of options, and you'll see them when you go to register a domain with a registrar. The domain name itself, the string that comes right before the TLD, is the part you register with the domain registrar. This name is registered in combination with the TLD. That is, you don't ever own a TLD, but you do pay a fee in order to obtain the right to use your chosen domain name in combination with a particular TLD. You can register a name with, say, the .com TLD, but that won't give you ownership of that name for any other TLD. The same domain name must be registered with as many TLDs as you wish to use. The local domain, or subdomain, like www, for example, is something that is configured with the DNS server. Usually, this is as simple as adding a few lines to a text file, but DNS records must be very precisely formatted, so different hosting providers will usually give you tools to help out with how to add these lines. The ways those tools work will depend upon the hosting provider. First, be careful when you choose a domain name. Generally speaking, these are some things you want to keep in mind. Shorter domain names are good. The shorter, the better. That said, many short domain names will be taken for any particular TLD. Don't be afraid to try other TLDs if you're really set on a particular name. Otherwise, it pays to be flexible. Check your spelling, if applicable. Sometimes a domain name is available only because you're not spelling the word correctly. It's always a good idea to check the Wayback Machine for your domain. If anyone has used the domain before, you'll have a chance to see how they've used it, and therefore how people might already be feeling about something you haven't even made yet. Do a general search for any words you plan on using, too. Take a look at what comes up. Sometimes a made-up word or name that you like might be a word in a foreign language or another company's brand. You'll be doing some of this searching with a registrar's domain search tool. All registrars provide them. There are many good registrars. Do a search for the best ones and compare them in much the same way as with hosting providers. Price, features, domain administration tools. In this case, price is a little more important because they're all selling basically the same product. Be sure to read a registrar's reviews to get a good idea about how they operate. When you've found a registrar you like, and you've used their tool to find a domain name you like, go ahead and follow the registrar's process for registering the name. After your payment is processed, you'll have to access the registrar's domain administration tools, and you'll be able to point that domain at your website. Instructions for that last step will be available with your hosting provider, and most hosting providers will assist with technical support if necessary. The stack. Pack your stack. Developers usually become comfortable with a select set of tools, usually called the dev stack. Stacks are often defined as database and server-side language combinations. Stack also might include web frameworks. Web server software, because it can be so integral to site development, is sometimes considered a part of the stack too. The truth is that web development is a complicated and ever-changing landscape, and choosing a stack helps to frame that geography and put it into context. As you move along in your development career, new languages, frameworks, and server technologies are going to become the hot new thing almost every single year. You're going to feel pressure to adapt and to change, and in some cases, you won't have much choice. New technologies can be that pervasive and insistent. That said, there's a real benefit to learning one set of tools inside and out. Having a go-to set of tools means that you're not reinventing the wheel every time you start a new project. You can become faster, more efficient, and less error-prone, and you can devote more time to understanding complicated principles of development that are independent of the tools you're using. As stated before, the components of a web stack consist of the web server, the database, often located on a separate server, and a server-side language. The web server is an important part of any stack due to its role as a site's front door. Web server software, like Apache, can perform some complicated processing, including authentication, URL parsing and rewriting, turning a URL into a different URL based upon business rules and how the site wants to interpret a request, caching, temporarily storing documents and assets so that they don't have to be generated again and can be served quickly, encryption, and more. Because an HTTP server is so fundamental to a site's purpose, knowing how to properly configure and deploy server software is essential. The server-side language used to develop a site will often be a matter of taste and what you know. Some languages will be better suited to certain tasks, though, depending upon the kind of site you're building. JavaScript and Node.js are excellent choices for high-performance sites that provide useful software services to users. JavaScript is a basic language included with all web browsers, making it a natural choice for passing data back and forth between server and client. In contrast, a language and framework combination like Python and Django will be perfect for larger sites that will benefit from Python's excellent standard software libraries and its tendency to produce elegant code. Many developers will find Python applications easier to maintain and grow. Also, if a client is using Python elsewhere in their organization, then Python might be the most natural choice for web development. Any language will have strengths and weaknesses to consider. Any site that provides data as a service or performs e-commerce functions will be connected to a database. In web development, there are many databases that have become popular. More significantly, while any server-side language will work with any database, some databases have become associated with specific languages and frameworks. The MongoDB document-oriented database has become pretty familiar for JavaScript-based developers. Developers working with Python or Ruby will often be using the PostgreSQL open-source relational database. Non-relational databases like MongoDB allow data structures like JavaScript arrays and objects to be represented pretty easily, even if the objects don't all have the same properties or data types. Relational databases are strong for serving data that is very consistent and easily categorized, with strong relationships between the categories. Okay, so if you're scratching your head, honestly, don't worry about it. These concepts are coming fast, and you'll get used to them. Again, the main point is to understand that not all databases work the same way, and certain languages have, for whatever reasons, become associated with certain databases. Those associations aren't engraved in steel. Let's take a look at a few popular stacks. LAMP, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. The LAMP stack is one of the oldest stacks in web development. It consists of a Linux server, or servers, running Apache HTTP server software. PHP is a server-side language that was created in 1995 expressly for the purpose of developing websites. This makes PHP a little unusual, because other common web development languages, like Python, Ruby, or Java, are also used for other general-purpose applications. MySQL was, for a very long time, the default go-to web-oriented relational database. It's a free-to-use database that has evolved along with the web itself, and which has been used on many thousands of websites. This is a time-tested, if largely out-of-fashion, web dev stack. Just because it's old-school, though, doesn't mean that it isn't worthwhile or capable of running some great sites. If you're creating a site that uses familiar forms of well-structured data, an e-commerce site, for example, that will sell well-understood products, or a social media site with users that will have nicely modeled relationships to each other, this is a solid stack. Mean, Mongo, Express, Angular, Node. The Mean stack is pretty modern. It too has been around for some time, enough time to be considered tested and reliable, but it's rather different from the LAMP stack. The MongoDB database is a non-relational database, meaning that it doesn't structure data according to a system of tables with nicely labeled rows and columns. Data can be stored and retrieved even when new components are being added to the data. There's no requirement of sticking to a strong definition of what a data record is. For the Internet of Things, which generates loads of changing data very quickly, this is a handy feature. JavaScript and Node.js power the Express Web Framework, which is a very flexible, somewhat minimal by itself, framework that's capable of serving many different contexts. It's relatively easy to learn. AngularJS is a framework that was developed at Google for use with their various projects. It's a very powerful framework that works well with Express. AngularJS enables, among other things, component-based web development, which is a way of thinking about web pages as collections of updatable representations of data. Wow! Did you read that last phrase three times? We did too. If you're creating a site that will allow users to query your own data, or which will offer software as a kind of service to users, the Mean Stack is a great choice. Developing for every browser in the galaxy. When thinking about web platforms, we always end up back at the browser. Browsers are complicated pieces of software, and certain browsers have played a significant role in the development of the web. For example, Microsoft's Internet Explorer 6 was a widely hated web browser when first introduced in 2001. Because of Windows' very large market share at the time, IE6 was widely distributed but largely ignored web standards. That made it very difficult to create websites that displayed similarly across other browsers operating on different platforms. This went on for a while, and developers were desperate for users to switch to browsers with better standards compliance and stronger security. In response to IE6, the Mozilla Foundation created the Firefox web browser in 2002. Firefox had a number of the features that both developers and users wanted, and it started to steal market share from IE6. In 2008, Google released the first version of its Chrome browser and relatively quickly began to attract large numbers of users due to its speed and standards compliance. Both Firefox and Chrome allowed developers to promote standards compliance as a primary way to ensure that websites displayed correctly across all browsers and all platforms. But there are some things you can do to ensure that your site displays correctly across all platforms, on all browsers, everywhere in the galaxy where beings use the web. Use the correct doc type. Most of the time, that means using the doc type for HTML5. Sometimes you'll inherit someone else's code, though, and you might need to use an older standard. Whatever the case, make sure the correct doc type is specified in the code so that the browser knows which standard you're targeting. Use a CSS reset. A CSS reset is a style sheet that loads first and which resets all HTML elements to explicitly defined CSS values. These values are always minimal baselines, but they're known. You don't have to guess at what Chrome might be doing differently than Firefox or Safari. This saves a lot of time and frustration during the development process. Use browser detection. There are several good JavaScript tools. Do a search, available for detecting the browser that is loading a site. This allows developers to write custom code when necessary, such as when three browsers support some CSS feature, but a fourth browser requires some extra code to make the feature work. Use code validation. The W3C offers code validation services, HTML validation, and CSS validation. These services will check your code for you to make sure that it adheres to standards. Woohoo! Use these tools and others that are available too. Standards-compliant code is much more likely to work the way it should. Use cross-browser testing. Cross-browser testing tools are available online and as browser add-ons or plugins that will allow you to view your site as it appears in a wide variety of browsers and platforms. Of course, you can, and should, load a variety of browsers on your machine too and make sure everything is rendering correctly. Read the standards. There's no substitute for knowledge. W3 standards. Browsers are moving targets, and development trends mean that new challenges will emerge when it comes to making a site for the Internet of Things. Standards are your friend here. Be a good friend to them. Invite them over for lunch. Use the nice plates. Trends. Speaking of moving targets, web platforms are always changing too. One recent stack trend is the JAMstack, JavaScript, APIs, and markup. The JAMstack relies on pre-generated sites that are served usually on content delivery networks, CDNs. The pre-generated refers to the practice of running some kind of tool, Jekyll, Gatsby, or Hexo to name a few, that generates all of the pages of a website, eliminating the need for a database to serve content. While this might sound like a potentially cumbersome step in the process, for many sites and many applications, this process works quite well. static pages can still use JavaScript to load dynamic content from web-hosted APIs, software as a service apps that can do pretty much anything you might want, e-commerce, data storage, you name it. This kind of site avoids many headaches. Provisioning servers and setting up HTTP software and databases are time-consuming tasks that then require maintenance and optimization follow-ups. None of this is super fun work. Deploying a JAM site is as simple as copying files over to a CDN provider. Browser requests are for static pages, at least initially, so JAM sites have a tendency to load fast. There are many advantages with this kind of stack. Serverless computing is yet another attempt to make server management easier and more affordable. With a serverless setup, a cloud computing provider, say Amazon, yes, they do this too, manages server resources that are dynamically allocated according to your site's needs. Developing a site of this kind means thinking of the site's services as a series of roles and functions. Getting into much detail is beyond the scope of this discussion. But yes, this is a different way to think about web development. The payoff is that, properly executed and in the right context, you have the potential to save a lot of money for large sites that would ordinarily require significant server backends. And there are yet more trends, all of which are demanding attention. Progressive web apps, GraphQL, front-end frameworks, the list goes on. However, and this is a big however, don't stress about it. While the websites you're making today might not be exactly the same kinds of sites that you're making tomorrow, you'll be surprised how well your knowledge serves you. There will always be something new to learn. But before long, you'll start developing a good sense of why and how innovations are working as they do. You'll get the need behind the innovations. Things might seem huge and complicated, but they'll clear up with time and practice. Knowledge check. Which of these is the stack of development tools? A. A CPU, RAM, and memory. Incorrect. A CPU, RAM, and memory are the three basic components of a computer, but they are not development tools. B. Chrome, Firefox, and Bing. Incorrect. Chrome, Firefox, and Bing are different web browsers. C. Web server, database, and server-side language. Correct. These are the three basic elements of the stack of development tools. D. B2B, B2G, and C2C. Incorrect. B2B, B2G, and C2C are three different kinds of e-commerce. Which of these is an emerging trend in web development tools? A. Serverless computing. Correct. Cloud-based solutions are becoming more common. B. Decreased use of IP addresses. Incorrect. Every device that connects to the internet has an IP address. C. Browsers that don't follow standards. Incorrect. Popular browsers follow standards to improve compatibility. D. A shift to domain name registrars. Incorrect. Domain name registrars have been around for a long time. They are responsible for selling domain names. 3. Why is it important to update server software? A. To reduce reliance on IP addresses. Incorrect. An IP address is the unique identifier of an internet-connected device. It isn't directly related to updating server software. B. To be sure that the latest updates are installed to promote security. Correct. Threats are constantly changing, and updates ensure that server software is up to the task. C. To accommodate new hosting providers. Incorrect. This isn't a reason to update server software. D. To permit two-factor authentication. Incorrect. Updated server software is generally not necessary to allow two-factor authentication. Conclusion. Choosing your development stack is a decision that will have a major impact on your website and how you manage it. You've learned to identify different types of websites and how best to support them. In particular, you have explored the world of servers and hosting providers with an eye to maximizing access and reliability for your clients. You've also considered how to choose and implement domain names, Now that you have got your toolkit put together, you're ready to move on to considering the architecture that will structure your site.